You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information.
Welcome to M Squared TechCast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving business, technology, and politics in Michigan. Now, your hosts, Matt Rausch and Mike Brennan.
Hey, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And we are coming to you over Zoom, as people are doing these days. All meetings are virtual these days. So this one is too, and we want to welcome you to this edition of the M-Squared TechCast at mitechnews.tv.
And we have calling in from way away, far away, Nelly Osterley, who, disclaimer, he's my webmaster and does my marketing for me online and all that jazz. And so he's with Smart Finds Marketing out of main office is Birmingham, although he is based a little outside of Birmingham. So what we're going to be talking about today with Mealy is, it's kind of what's going on with business in the sense of everyone. I know I had a lot of contracts that were supposed to start in April and everyone suspended them because they're all kind of, should we advertise, should we not? What's your thinking on that, Mealy?
You know, I think we're in a very interesting situation. And it's honestly not that much different from our 2009, 2010 economic crisis, not to mention that we all experienced that firsthand in the Motor City. I think the answer to the question is don't pull back. Your competitors are pulling back. That's great. That's an opportunity for you. You need to push forward and continue to spend your marketing dollars, including your advertising dollars. Keep your brand in front of people. Now, here's what we run into in this particular scenario. We run into the problem that my fellow baby boomers, I love to bash my fellow baby boomers because it's so bad at this. They tend to want to attribute every dime to some sale. And during an economic crisis like this, that is not an option. You're investing in your brand to be in front of the market. That's the answer to the question. So don't pull back right now because your competitors are.
And isn't there some measure of reassurance involved in that as well? Like, you know, we're still going to be here.
Well, exactly. I mean, what you're doing is you're garnering trust. You're letting the market know that you are not only are you solid, but they can trust you. You're going to be around in 3 months when this whole thing starts to shake out. So, yes, you want to be able to present that. You want to present that to the market in a way that they're going to be able to say, yep, I know this brand.
Okay, let's also talk about another thing that you're big on, which is relationship marketing. How does that play into this right now?
So one of the things about this whole process of keeping yourself in front of everybody is really, again, don't cut your spending, make sure that you're keeping yourself in front of the market. But what you want to be able to do is tap into the social space, the whole virtual world. And again, I apologize for my baby boomers, but they don't do a very good job in the virtual world. And what should be social selling, and that's been a term that's been on the market for a number of years, social selling should be something, should be number one on their list. And it's not. They're still continuing doing the cold phone calls, making the phone calls, going to conferences, putting themselves at risk and, expending unnecessary time and energy. Rather, especially if you're B2B, get onto LinkedIn, develop relationships in LinkedIn in such a way that people recognize who you are. You're building trust. But I will tell you this, social selling, and let's say we're using LinkedIn as our tool, allows you to be much more efficient. If you can only do, I'm just throwing out some numbers right now. Let's say you can only do 100 phone calls in a day, right? Through LinkedIn, you're able to stay in contact with a few hundred people within a day. It's a lot more efficient. And you start to develop a relationship with individuals within the marketplace. They can be partners. They can be strategic partners. They could be vendors. They could be clients or prospective clients. You're developing relationships in such a way that you're going to end up with sales. And again, using the same initial topic, this is the time to go into that marketplace and to develop those relationships today. So social selling is a form of relationship marketing.
Okay. All right. Go ahead, Matt.
Well, I was just wondering, you also talk about the concept of social nurturing. Let's talk about that for a little bit.
All right. So in order to be able to do social selling, in order to develop these, to do relationship marketing, building these relationships inside of the social communities, one of the things you're going to need to do is you need to tap into, so let's say, and I'm just throwing that as an example. Let's say that you share something from your company blog. You share it. And again, when you look at social media marketing, it falls into two categories. It's either passive or it's active. So passive social media marketing is what most people do. And what when I say most people, I'm saying most companies. So what they're doing is they're using tools like Hootsuite, and they're automating their social media marketing. That only goes so far. The next step really is, let's say that you shared a blog post from your company. You're going to want to make sure you have the right hashtags in there to get the right attention. You're going to want to tag other people. And basically, and I use this loosely, you're basically forcing them to come to that post that you shared and ask them to make a comment. If they comment, they're more likely to like what you posted. The more likes and comments you get, the more attention you get in these social communities. It doesn't really make a difference which one. And that in turn expands your viral marketing. It expands your brand and gets the message out. So this process is very important when it comes to not holding back right now, getting involved in terms of social selling and relationship marketing. And as part of your arsenal of things to do, you want to nurture what you're doing in social communities.
Is there go ahead, Matt.
Go ahead, Mike.
I actually am looking at a sheet that you sent me that, you talked about some Google accounts and things like that. What's going on with those? Can you explain what's happening with those?
Yes, absolutely. So this is a good time, our first topic was, hey, don't hold back right now, right? Spend your advertising and marketing dollars. You may not see an ROI the way you want it to right now, but eventually there is. A lot of the companies, large corporations, are in fact helping small businesses right now in particular. So Google just announced a $340 million Google Ads credit that they're giving to small businesses. There is one caveat that they don't have in their blog post about this, though. You need to have been active in your Google Ads account since the beginning of 2019. So they're not just giving it for free or saying, hey, everybody who's got an active Google account. Rather, they're saying it has to have been active since the beginning of 2019. Then we will give you this credit. If you do fall into that category, then the credit that they will give you, which they will add to your account, Google Ads account, if I understood the news correctly, sometime in the next month or 2 months, you have until the end of the year to use that credit. How much is the credit? Again, that seems to be a big unknown as well. Considering that Google has opened this up worldwide, I'm going to say, what we usually have seen from Google in the past is you get $50 or $100 credit, which could be beneficial, especially if you run a $10 a day ad that can last you for a good month or more. So not a bad situation, but Google is one of these. Facebook has a similar type of program that you might want to take a closer look at. Amazon is on board with helping small businesses. GoFundMe started a program in terms of being able to help businesses out as well. To be perfectly honest, the list goes on. There's quite a number of large corporations with cash on hand trying to figure out how to help small businesses survive this current pandemic. I think it's a good thing on their part. because it's been in the news that Google's advertising spend has been dropping. So what they're trying to do is keep everybody in the market and to continue to spend, number one. But even, like I said, even if these companies didn't do this, I'm still of the philosophy that you need to stay in the market. You need to figure out how to continue your marketing activities, run your ads, and get involved in social media marketing, especially in the B2B world. Get into LinkedIn and continue your efforts.
So how do you think companies could best use their budget, including these little freebies here and there during this crisis? What's the best way to use it?
So there's a few different ways to think about this. The budgets are not that big, but let's start with the advertising, which I think most people understand the easiest way. So what you could do is run, let's say, a $10 a day ad spend. That's not bad, especially if you use the geographic tools and the other tools to hone in on targeting your audience. So instead of trying to going after 100,000 people, consider going after 100 people. That might be better. I understand the 100 example is extreme, but narrow your advertising to an area that makes sense, whether it's geography, which is most likely. The next item might be industry. The next item might be, for example, if you're targeting individuals, what level within a corporation they are. Do you want to only target C-levels or managers or directors, that type of thing? Narrow your focus. And this way you can take advantage of this $100 or $50 or whatever number of dollars that you're able to get from these other corporations, plus your own ad spend. You can draw it out so that you, because I'm pretty confident we're going to need to make it last for the next 90 days to get over this hump. Let's see what happens by the time we get to August and September. So think of this from April, May, June, possibly July. Plan your budgets out accordingly. Best suggestion I have to this question is narrow your targeting.
Okay. And so this is now shameless plug time. So you get to talk about how people can reach out to you to get your assistance on how to spend their money during this pandemic time.
No doubt. So first of all, my first name is Maley. My last name is Ostele. I am the CEO of Smart Finds Marketing. We're located in Birmingham, Michigan. We've been in business for over 25 years. Our entire focus is digital marketing. We're a digital marketing agency. We manage a client's entire web presence, whether it's their domain names, their websites, their marketing, their advertising, their local ecosystem, their newsletters, their CRMs, etc. Essentially, after this many years, we have a lot of experience. We have a lot of knowledge that we use to develop these strategic tools. And I would suggest to get more information, come to our website, smartfindsmarketing.com.
Okay.
All right. Thanks very much, Maley Ostele, smartfindsmarketing.com. Thanks for being with us today. We'll be back in just a minute with another segment of the M Squared TechCast. For right now, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
MITechnews.tv and a whole bunch of other places.
Other places, all over the place.
Lawrence Technological University graduates earn a degree and a higher starting salary. In fact, when it comes to earning potential, the Brookings Institution ranks LTU's fifth among U.S. colleges and universities. Be enriched. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at LTU.edu.
As a Lawrence Technological University graduate, you're not only marketable, you're worth more. Yes, more. According to Payscale.com, when it comes to graduate salaries, LTU is in America's top 100. Be invaluable. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America.
On a
campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at LU.edu.
Hey, it's Matt Rausch.
Mike Brennan.
And you're watching our first virtual episode of the M Squared TechCast. We're using today's sort of video conferencing technology so we can all shelter in place like we're supposed to.
Yes. Well, last week we did the last show. Actually, we weren't even in the TV studio because that was too close. So we moved to the audio studio, and then Dave said, well, the engineers are a little uncomfortable with all these different folks coming in for all these shows, so we had to go virtual. So here you are. So not too much different, just different talking heads. And we have with us Shannon O'Hara. She's calling.
Hi.
Hey, you are. She's calling in from New York. She's the sister of one of my business partners, Kate O'Hara, who's probably watching, so we need to give Kate a shout-out, right?
Hi, Kate.
Or I'll never hear the end of it. And so Shannon is in the fashion apparel business for – I'll let you explain. I know who you are. I don't want to give away too much, but what do you want to tell folks about what you're doing in New York?
Well, I mean, my normal job is that I am personally a tailor. I've been a tailor for 25 years, and I'm a highly specialized tailor. I normally work with fashion designers and stylists to dress celebrities and, you know, do high-end advertising. And my co-founder and I started last week. We were... we're in all these industry chat groups, like email chains, and in the entire fashion and entertainment business in New York, you know, shut down because the governor has, you're not allowed to be running unless you're an essential group. So none of the factories that make apparel in New York are running. None of the tailors I know are working. None of the films are shooting, you know, everybody is at home. And we started seeing everybody on our email chat lines and so forth. Just saying, like, I have a home studio. I have a studio. I could be making masks. Let's all like, and we watched everybody trying to figure out how they could make 50, 100 masks in their home. And we just realized we have a giant pool of labor and every single stitcher, tailor, person I know has a full studio with professional industrial machinery in their home, and they could be making all these PPEs. Then to top that off, we also are connected to several factories that are not allowed to run, but they all have industrial cutting machines, and they could be cutting large scale PPEs. Like, you know, somebody in their home is physically with scissors cutting out, but these machines cut 250 layers of fabric at a time. So we estimate that if we put just the factories that we're working with currently and not reaching out to even more, if we put them to work, we could be cutting probably between 25 to 100,000 PPEs a week. Now in order to put ourselves to that, and we have the stitchers and tailors to do all that work. And there's right now we have a little over 500 professional tradesmen that were working in either the apparel industry or entertainment industry that are set up at home to do all the sewing. And the beauty of what we're doing is that no one is in the room together.
Right. And you call it this the Skilled Laborers Brigade, right?
Yes, we do. That it's because really that we are a collection of factory owners and the actual people who sew garments. And I think that's important because there's a lot of, there are a lot of people that are volunteering to make PPEs and, you know, people that are making masks who are not industry professionals, and they're doing a wonderful job and they're doing a great job making masks. But I just know the volume, like, where it may take a home sewer, you know, let's say 20 minutes to make a mask. It would take a professional 2, you know, so we can put, and not to mention what I said about the cutting machines. Like,
sure.
I can cut out 5,000 masks on one cutting machine in one day.
Now, what you're going to do is hospital gowns, if I believe that's correct, right?
I mean, I was just using masks as an example. We are in the process of speaking with mills about getting the medical grades fabrics.
Where's the fabric coming from?
This is the big issue that everyone's having and why these PPEs aren't being flooded into the market really quickly is that a mill that's making medical grade fabric is not something that somebody from the public can contact. Like you have to buy massive amounts of fabric at once. So you can't, which is fine because we need massive amounts to cut out our potential. But the other issue that we're having, why we're in the situation we're in globally, is because we made a choice a couple decades ago to make all these medical gear out of disposable fabric. So the mills haven't been making that much launderable fabric. So, and that's what we need to be using now. Like in order to make gear in a non-sterile set up giant factory, you have to be able to wash it to sterilize it. So right. Everybody now wants launderable masks and gowns, and you can't buy that unless you're buying large amounts. We're talking to hospitals and we're talking to governmental agencies about trying to get that going. But in the meantime, none of the people I'm working with want to sit idle. So, I mean, we're cutting out 5,000 masks today that my stitchers are going to be getting tomorrow and they're going to be working on, you know, so we're working. I'm very frustrated that we're not working to our full potential, which could,
yeah, you could scale up if you had the raw material.
Yeah. And, 5,000 is an impressive number, but 100,000 is a more impressive number.
Yep. So now, is there any way, we're in Michigan, obviously, is there any way for folks like you in Michigan? I'm sure we have them here in the Detroit area because we have a bit of an entertainment industry here. Is there any way for them to work with you?
Oh, definitely. We are, one of the things that, like, I won't go into the nuts and bolts of the production process we've made up, but we have specifically, it isn't as simple as just like picking up the cutout mask or gown and dropping it off. We are working with another organization to set up like virtual quality control and safety control. So like they're developing a QR code for us so that we can constantly be in monitoring of what they're making and that they're making it safely. And this is all done remotely, you know, and we have people that have signed that are part of our ranks that are professionals in different parts, you know, outside of New York City. Right. I mean, a lot of them are New York City just because that's the people I'm personally connected to, but we could for sure do this nationally, not to mention, if anybody across the country wants to order from us, like the mail is still running in New York. You know, there's no reason we can order fabric. I think we are in the middle of ordering fabrics, like additional fabrics. We're finding we can get a fabric within a couple days. It takes a couple days to cut and sew. Like you could get it in under a week, probably.
Now, New York is certainly one of the epicenters in America right now of the pandemic. So initially, on the stuff that you're creating, PPEs, and we should define that term. Go ahead and define the term for the audience.
I've been steeped in phone calls with politicians and everyone's just saying PPE. That stands for personal protective equipment. So what that is everything that the hospitals are running out of: isolation gowns, protective coveralls, face masks, booties, headgear, like the things that protect a nurse or a doctor from getting sick. And the other thing that we want, that we have been getting, I would say a majority of the people contacting us for help have not necessarily been ER rooms. It's been, you know, we have, who we're cutting out for today is a group of OBGYNs who don't have masks for labor and delivery. Uh-huh. And, you know, or we're making masks for some, a large group of firemen. You've got fire, police. What about the people that are in prisons? What about the large grocery store chains? You know, like there are, honestly, the research I've been reading, they're showing that South Korea has a much slower infection rate. And that government requires every single person to be wearing a mask when they go out in public. So, I mean, we potentially could be making for just your next door neighbor.
Right.
Right, exactly. Yeah, they have flattened the curve. We have not yet. So.
Yeah, I mean, I'm afraid that New York may be a little past the curve.
Yeah.
Well, that hospital ship just arrived today just to take the normal patients so all the New York hospitals could focus on the COVID-19 patients. So it'll be interesting to see how that all works out.
Yeah, here in Detroit, they're setting up the convention center as an overflow hospital just for the COVID-19 patients. So. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I've been following a little bit of Michigan just because I have family there. The news just comes at you, a mile a minute.
Yeah, absolutely. So if we want to keep you on, we're going to have Fred Brown on for the third segment, and I think the two of you could discuss these things together. But if people want to reach out to you, they want to participate in your skilled labor brigade, I can do it. How would they do that? So,
well, we've set up a website. I have to say, we've done all this in 6 days. We've put together a 500 employee plus or employee / volunteer plus manufacturing production line in less than a week. Mm-hmm. And so, we also set up a website so people can contact us. It's skilledlaborersbrigade.com. Okay. And if you would like to join our ranks as a craftsman who is a skilled laborer, we have a page for that. If you would like to donate so that we can, for these projects that we're trying to just do large scale cutting for, we have a / donate page. And if you also are interested in amplifying your production process, like there's plenty of people that, designers and people that are making their own efforts with, their 10 employees. Well, if you want to amplify that, we can add 10 or 500 employees to your process.
Okay. Go ahead. Did you want to say
something? No, I'm done. Go ahead.
Oh, no. Matt, did you want to say something?
Well, I just wanted to give her the opportunity to plug her regular business after this is all over, since she's been so kind to be with us today.
Oh, I really appreciate that. Actually, the level of tailoring that I do, I work specifically with celebrities, so you have to be a fashion designer to contact me. But who knows if where we'll be after this comes out. I may regret having not given you my phone number, but I mean, I currently... I've been doing this for 25 years. I'm pretty word of mouth, but thank you.
Well, and finally, before Fred does join us, so how are your folks handling what's going on in New York right now? It's a very nasty situation. So how are things going?
I would say that in New York City, the majority of the people that I talk with take it extremely serious. When I go, poke my head outside my house, neighbors are all distancing themselves. My husband is an essential worker for the city of New York City, so he's still working. And he comes home and takes it seriously, takes his shoes off, is fully cleaning himself before changing his clothes before he even walks in the house, in the garage. And it's pretty serious.
Okay.
If you don't work with Skilled Laborers Brigade, if you get anything from my interview, it's please take this seriously and please, take off your shoes, wash your hands, wear a mask, like take it seriously.
Sure. Okay. We're going to do a quick 1 minute commercial break and hopefully we'll come back with Fred Brown, who will join us, and then we'll continue the conversation.
Thank you.
All right. So we'll be right back with, Fred, relax. So right there, I see Fred's queued up and ready to go. But first, we're going to go to commercial break. This is Mike Brennan.
And it's Matt Rausch.
And you're watching, a kind of different edition of MI Tech TV.
What do you get at Lawrence Technological University? Everything. Great labs and studios, supportive professors, plus a full campus life, NAIA athletics, and all the software you need to succeed. Be smart. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Find out more at LTU.edu.
Lawrence Technological University is all about opportunity. You learn beyond the campus, doing real-world research for top companies and honing your skills through co-ops and internships. Apply what you learn. Be challenged. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at LTU.edu.
Hey, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And we're back with a virtual episode of the M Squared TechCast. We are, like most people these days, talking about the coronavirus pandemic, and we have a genuine expert with us now, Fred Brown. Fred, why don't you tell people, first of all, sort of establish your authoritativeness here. Tell us a little bit about your background in the healthcare industry to start with. Fred, you got to turn your audio on. There we go.
I'm not hearing him.
It says connecting to audio, so he'll be with us in a second. Okay. And he's still not. Fred, we still can't hear you.
I can hear you on the phone. I just can't.
There we go.
So I have to do it on the phone. Is that all right?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, well, let's have to wing it. Can you still hear us, Fred?
I can hear you, yes.
So once again, Fred, give us a little bit of your background and your authority to speak on these matters.
Well, I'm a medicinal biochemist by training, and I have I've been in the business of managing epidemics like this with drugs and vaccines for about 40 years. The first big event that I had to coordinate was HIV, and luckily our lab was the first lab to develop a test that actually identified the HIV virus, and we rolled that out to tests all over the world that really helped control the HIV virus and got us in control for therapeutics. And I've then worked on Ebola and Zika and SARS and H5N1 and so on as they rolled through the population. This is the first time we've had to do this in the United States, but I've done this probably five or six times as a manager responsible for managing demand of critical drugs.
All right. So, you wrote a, shall I say, scary blog
sobering.
Posted. I read through it carefully, and your thesis is prepare for a long haul through September.
Yeah, that's based on my experience. In my experience, we're not as organized as we probably should be at this point to control the virus as quickly as we'd like to. And what concerned me was that we weren't getting very much attention to the virus already in February and March. And so I started to blog. And as a result of the blog, people started to ask me questions. And one of the questions that came back was, how long is the shutdown going to last after we started the shutdown? It was a friend of mine in Austin, Texas. He said, "Oh, look, I'm signing deals. I've got rent to pay. I'm a real estate guy. What should I think about in terms of coming back to work? When are things going to get back to normal? If I've got to close deals personally, shake people's hands, and get all over the United States and world?" And I said, "Well, in my estimation, I actually used the model very much like the one that Mayor Cuomo's using in New York. And in my estimation, using that model and being conservative, that basically we would go through a peak of in the United States of mid to end of May, be conservative, I said, if I'm end of May. And then in order to make sure you're really done with the infection rate, then you have to wait for, unfortunately, this virus takes a long time to work through its system. It takes 40 days to go through a complete cycle of disease. And so you had 40 days, plus you're not really sure whether you really stopped it. And so I thought, for breakout areas, you'll probably have to wait about 100 days, which is what they did in China. And for non-breakout areas, if your community is lucky enough to miss it, it'll be about 60 days after we think we've got control of the peak, at the peak. So putting that together, you get kind of early August for the non-breakout areas and late August for the breakout area, late July for the breakout areas, for the non-breakout areas and late August for the breakout areas, if we're lucky. If we're not lucky, we jump back into the
situation too quickly, everyone gets reinfected again. It takes a while for the virus to ramp that back up. We won't detect that because we don't have enough testing in our system yet in order to detect when the virus is simply moving back and forth. And around Thanksgiving, we'll have another huge breakout, which would be very unfortunate. So that's why I said to be conservative, we probably have to wait until late August before you really plan to have, you know, significant normalcy in your life. Probably September, you can start to think about being normal again, if we're lucky.
Now, one of the things I mentioned to you when we were talking before the show was I watched a news report this morning where the FDA has approved some sort of antibody virus detection. And again, this is not my area of expertise. But we would tell whether someone had the immunity, had gone through the disease, and therefore could go back to work. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, you just watched me touch my face twice during that discussion. That's what you shouldn't be doing. Just to let you know. So basically there's several different kinds of tests we have in order to detect disease. And one of them, what we're using right now, is actually detecting the DNA. And that's the PCR test that's being used right now. And that was from a company that I used to work for, Hoffman LaRoche, developed this test. It came out very quickly because you can very quickly get the DNA available for the virus. And the problem with that test is it takes, you know, if you're very, very good with it and have a very automated environment, you can get it done in 45 minutes. Most of us don't have those kinds of capabilities. About 168 labs in the United States do. So normally it takes about 2 hours to really get a good test result. And that's if you're lucky enough to get a sample with the right conditions and so on. So there's a small chance that you won't even get a sample, even if you have the disease, to be able to test properly. So the ELISA test, these antibody tests actually detect antibodies. Usually the antibodies are developed about 5 days after you acquire the disease. So after 5 days, your body says, hey, there's something foreign in my body. And they develop antibodies to start to reroute the disease and start to attack the disease. And at this point, you can actually detect in your blood whether or not you've got these antibodies. And that's extremely important, because what happens in these diseases is that you can tell who's been infected. Because we don't know right now, we don't have enough data to know right now whether or not you've been infected or not. We don't know what they call asymptomatic levels of the disease are. And that's very important to know, because we're about 81% of us right now, according to what we know, won't really have much symptom, or will have a minor condition. Within that 81%, we're not sure what percentage. It's between probably 30 and 50% of those people actually don't have any disease at all. They'll have a little cold or sniffle, and they won't realize that they have the disease at all. And knowing that who has antibodies is important, because as you start to roll out, there's an immunity conferred that occurs because you've got these antibodies. And so one of the big therapeutic areas that has the biggest chance of working fastest is if we can find those people who have the antibodies, pull the antibodies in their blood out into and spin that blood down and give it to people who are really sick, so they've got a better immune system available. So not only are these antibody detection systems important to understand who has the disease, who doesn't have the disease, that's a diagnosis. Also, it's important to understand monitoring who has had the condition and who has not had the condition. And then from there, you can actually start to do some defensive work therapeutically. And that's probably about 3 months away. Just to give you a sense, when I was doing this for Roche, I was responsible, my team was responsible for Tamiflu distribution as well as test distribution. We could tell by the time, you know, you've never heard of H5N1, but that almost broke out. And luckily we had Tamiflu, which stopped the flu's length and the severity of symptom. And we had diagnostics tests. So by the time at the end of the epidemic, that was breaking out in Europe, we could tell virtually, we only had about a third of the drugs we needed at the time for capacity reasons. We could tell exactly who needed to get the drug to stop the disease, create the herd immunity, and prevent it from spreading. And we were about a few days away from it really breaking out into the world. So it's that close. And to give you a sense of the level of testing you'll need, I did the numbers, and it's about, we talk about how many tests we've done so far, about 845,000 tests. That's starting in January to today. We'd have to do that every 3 days for the rest of the year. Oh. I'm sorry, for another year to get to the level of testing that we were at to control the H5N1 outbreak. that gives you a sense of how far behind we are testing.
Why is it taking so long to ramp up mass production of the tests?
Well, you have to get enough of the antibody. The antibody has to be stable. This is a living system that's creating the antibody. You've got to format the tests. Luckily, these tests are much more available than PCR tests. There are 18,000 machines like this outside in the United States versus only 168 that we had for the PCR test. Korea has a testing capacity of about 100,000. They are at about the right level. They can give us a few of those tests, but that's sort of, and they're one sixth of our population. That gives you a sense of where we are. Luckily, these tests have moved then from a 2-hour pattern to about a 15-minute pattern. You can even get a positive result in 5 minutes, a negative result in 15 minutes. So you get a sense of how much faster the throughput is and how much more capacity we have to do these tests. Another nice thing about these is they go through the mail a lot better, so we'll be able to involve a lot more tests. But if you talk right now, for example, to Beaumont, they can do about 400 PCR tests a day. That's all. And they had 8,000 requests in the last couple of days. So you can get a sense of when people saying, you know, we got to get better with testing. We got to get really better with testing. Otherwise, we're going to be, and that's why I'm saying that it's unlikely that we're going to be able to control the virus that well already. You know, so yesterday it was revealed that the U.S. government was using someone named Chris Murray's model. He's done University of Washington, excellent epidemiologist, obviously. But if you look at his material, it looks like the test goes up and down very rapidly. I'm sorry, the disease incident goes up and down very rapidly in the United States, throughout the whole United States. And my assumptions were that it's going to be hard to make that happen, that everywhere is going to break out about the same time and get better about the same time. I don't think that's likely, but you know, that was one of the simplifications, so you can look at every state, which I didn't do.
Matt, you have some questions?
Yeah, I was just curious. The people that are considered essential workers, what precautions do you suggest they take in the current environment?
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, so there are a couple things. There are non-essential workers, and then there are essential workers. For the essential workers, you should really confirm, number one, that you've got to do the work personally, physically there. If you don't have to do the work personally, physically there, or you can transfer the work to someone else who is already there or already, then do that. Don't go to a site just because you're an essential worker and can. If you can work remotely successfully and complete the task, do that. Do not go out, even though you are an essential worker and officially you're allowed to show up. And if you don't have that equipment, then buy it and do it at home. That's number one thing. Number two is if you're living with a family, then essential workers who are in healthcare know this already, but you should really have a facility where you can disrobe outside your door, signal the family that you're coming in, have them clear out the area where you need to get to take a shower, take an immediate shower, soaping, you know, all the way through your body. And preferably with a special chemical soap, which I'll send it over to you with the name of it. Special chemical soap that creates a film that prevents viruses from coming back onto you. And then it's a hexachlorine, but it has a pink soap you can buy in the pharmacy, or have it shipped to you. Don't buy it in the pharmacy. Ship it to you. When you're done taking your shower, come out with gloves and safety protection on. Put your dirty clothes and equipment on. Wipe it all down. Throw it in the washer. Wash it and dry it under high heat. And wipe all the things you've used that day, including your truck and everything else, down completely with a soaking alcohol disinfectant. That should remain on the equipment for at least 2 to 3 minutes in a wet form before you wipe it off.
Wow. It's like a bad horror movie or something, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And if you're not an essential worker, and especially if you've got any prior condition, if you're young or old, your chances of a fatal incident with this COVID-19 doubles if you smoke. It doubles if you have heart condition. It doubles if you have diabetes. The numbers are actually you know, somewhat worse than that for her heart condition, actually. So you've got to be, you're moving from about a 1% chance of dying to a 10% chance of dying. It's literally that bad. So, and then as you get older, you move from a 1% chance of dying to a, once you get to our age, you're talking about a 3.5% chance of dying. And if you're talking about someone who's in their 80s, it's a 14 to 15% chance of dying. So the people who get sick and are likely to have illness will know it within about 8 days. They'll be on ventilators. And if you go on a ventilator, you have about the same, you have about a 50% chance of living, depending on the hospital you go. It could be as good as 30%, but usually it's 50-50. So that's the sort of risk you're taking right now. If you are elderly with an underlying condition, do not go out. Do not go near anyone in the family who does go out. Because if you're with a family, the chance of getting the disease equals the weakest link in your family. That means, you know, even if you're completely perfect, sanitizing regularly, wiping down surfaces every day at least, and more often than that, every time you touch them, even if you're preparing food right, if your family member goes out and gets the disease, that's your level of risk you're facing.
Wow. So don't gather the family for Easter, clearly, right?
No, that was one of the things I was most worried about. My friend in Austin said, well, I just invited everyone over for Easter. We're going to have a big celebration, you know, get all my contracts signed and everything's going to be great. And that's when I started to do the math.
Huh. All right. So there's been talk of various treatments. There's that malaria treatment that seems to be floating around the internet as a possibility. Most people are saying vaccines are still at least a year away, if not more. What's your take on that?
Yeah, so it's going to be difficult to control this disease until we do have either a treatment or a vaccine. So we'll have to have significant social distancing measures in place, even if we have control of the disease, and even if it becomes sort of a rolling condition through the world, until we have a vaccine. Or an effective treatment. The most likely effective treatment in the short term is what they call a serum treatment. You combine sera of people who've already had this disease, spin it down, and inject it into people who are at high risk. That confers an immunity on them, similar to the kind of immunity you'd have if you got the disease and survived it, then you'd have antibodies in your system that would help you do that. That was the calculation that was made by President Trump when he decided to hold off on lifting the shut-in operations past Easter. Was that they calculated that if they did this and let the virus simply run, let everyone get herd immunity, it would probably kill about 2.2 million Americans. My numbers were a little bit higher than that because I was being more conservative, but it's in that range. It's in the kind of 1 to 4 million range. So that's why he correctly said, you know, we had an aspiration, we wanted to hit Easter, but I can't do it. And that was the number that he looked at to say, you know, it doesn't make sense yet. And he'll continue to look at those numbers, I'm sure, as time goes on. So that's a good sign. And then. So where was that? I'm sorry. What was that?
we were talking about treatments. I wanted to ask you about.
So the treatment that sera treatment is going to be the most effective one in about the next 3 to 4 months. We'll be able to identify people who have the disease with the ELISA assay, and we'll be able to treat people with a mixture of sera, hopefully in about 3 to 5 months.
How about? I've also heard that there's a blood pressure drug that's being. I've heard that there's a blood pressure drug that's a possibility as well as sort of a. Some kind of palliative?
Well, yeah. So the way the disease progresses is twofold. Number one, you get an infection. The infection can be controlled by antiretrovirals, and those are the ones you're hearing about that have that end in VIR at the end. Famotidine and a few others. Famotidine is the Chinese one. And these have a lot of side effects. But they can be quite effective. And what they do is they stop the virus from reproducing. That's phase one of the viral infection. The next stage of the viral infection is it starts to cause a lot of a lot of inflammation. And in order to stop the inflammation and the destruction of the what they would call a cytokine storm, to stop it from hurting your body, what happens is your body over responds to the viral infection, and it starts to eat itself. And so if you look at these people who are dying, what happens is they actually have holes in their lungs with the body eating itself, which is a permanent problem, even if you survive the infection. Wow. And then, of course, you are very open to getting other infections like pneumonia that'll also kill you more rapidly. So you can imagine that there are a number of drugs in the area that are trying to actually reduce that cytokine inflammation. And then there are more palliative drugs that people are looking at to try to reduce inflammation symptoms. So those are the kind of four areas of drug work. And it's going to take us about 3 months to get this monoclonal antibody cocktail spun down in sufficient quantity to even start the process of looking at people. But it'll take, with existing drugs, we could have them on the market more quickly. But we have to go to the FDA. Will have to do some specialized testing called the master protocols that allow them to look at all the different drugs that are out there. There are about 70 out there right now. WHO feels have an opportunity. None of them are considered what we would call, a high likelihood of success. But there are, at least they have some likelihood of success. And then it's going to take about 12, the fastest I've ever gotten a vaccine in the market is about 14 months. They have new technology out there that could get it down to as little as 12, but they've never been successful. So these are the nuclear vaccines that are, very specialized and new to the market. They're a little bit safer. They use a platform instead of a completely new construct each time. And so you can get them through the regulatory process more rapidly.
So, we talked about this again before we started the show, and in the summer in Michigan, that's when everybody gets together, goes to sporting events, goes outdoors. Can we actually do that this summer?
Well, by yourself, you can, absolutely.
No Comerica Park or anything, right?
Yeah, or if you're married and have regularly with somebody, that's probably safe. I wouldn't get together with until the CDC says we have control and we are treating patients on an individual rather than a population social separation basis, I wouldn't get together in large groups. The way to figure out how big the group can be is you measure your room and you figure out 6 feet of distance between everybody, and then you can figure out about how many people you can have in the room. If you go outside, it's a little bit easier. The other thing that's good about outside is that it has more ventilation. More ventilation is important. And then, of course, you want to keep all of the hand washing going. You want to keep all of the disinfectants and sanitization of surfaces going in that process. So generally, it's going to be more difficult. We might have I wouldn't count on this, but some coronaviruses are more susceptible to heat. And so as it gets hotter, and especially as it gets more humid, the reason that the virus spreads is because there are droplets in your sputum. And so as it gets more humid, these droplets can't travel quite as far. So there's a slight reduction in the amount of space you can have between you. In the lab, we use laminar airflow, which again blows things away so that we can get slightly higher concentrations of people in. But I wouldn't risk it until August. Until the CDC says we're at a point of containment and we've got a way of managing individual patients as they come through the door. Well, the thing that really kills people as well, when you get out of control in the hospital, that really causes fatality rates to go up.
And football is a religion in this country, and that starts in September. What's the outlook for college and pro football, things, high school football? Is any of that safe to do?
It's too early to tell. I mean, all these models have a lot of assumptions built into them. We just don't have the data yet. We've had to make some simplifying assumptions. Once we get the data, it'll be a lot easier to say with a lot more accuracy what the right data is and what the right control systems are. My guess is that my real hope is that in September we'll get to a point of normalcy and enough control where we'd have at least some audiences available. I wouldn't say very large. I think you have to keep, you know, kind of two roles around you is pretty separate, but at least, you know, at a U of M, they could probably get, you know, 10,000-20,000 people into the stadium and get things going.
So don't buy those season's tickets this year, huh?
I don't know is the answer. I really don't know. I'd love to be able to say absolutely, but I'm not sure. Certainly not August, not the pre-game, not the preseason August tickets, no.
Well, I was going to say that the guy at Spartan Stadium always starts the game with, it's a beautiful day for football, no matter what the weather is. You know, he always says it's a beautiful day for football. But it sounds like a beautiful day for football at home in front of your television is what it's sounding like.
Yeah, yeah. I think, unfortunately, it's going to be a while until really we have a medical solution to this. We're going to have to practice the social distancing. You know, it's just a matter of once we know the mortality rate, the length of the duration of the disease better, and the transmission rates really accurately, and then have an effective diagnostic that can, you know, test. So in Michigan football, the way to do that would be you'd have a thermal test, or you'd have a monoclonal antibody test of everyone who went into the building. And if anyone tested positive, you wouldn't allow them in unless they had a certificate that said, I'm cured of the disease. If they have herd immunity or they don't have the disease, you let them into the stadium. If they do, you turn them away before they get into the stadium. Hmm. So when you do that, then it's possible to have a football game with audience.
Well, you don't do the lines for the metal detectors for long. Jeez.
Yeah, you need a lot of detectors. You need a lot of police to help guide the crowd. You wouldn't allow people to stand in the crowd. It'd take you a few hours to load the stadium, a few hours to the stadium actually go pretty well because, you know, everyone was in the stadium was either immune or been tested negative. So so getting out of the stadium, you'd be okay. Getting in, it'll take you, you know, if the tests come down from 5 minutes to 30 seconds, that would be ideal. And if they only cost about 5 cents, people would probably be willing to spend the money to do that. But that's what would be necessary, that level of support of the game. And then you could do it, I think. Mm. In August, in September.
Yeah.
Well, so, we got to get through April 1st.
Yeah, that's true. Very true. So, all right, Fred, I don't know if Shannon's still with us or not. Are you there, Shannon? I see your icon, but I don't know if you're actually with us.
Oh, I wanted to give Shannon an idea. I wasn't able to listen in, unfortunately.
All right, go ahead, Shannon. We can hear you. Go ahead, talk.
Great. Yeah, I'd love to hear your idea. Thank you so much. That was one of the most informative segments I've heard yet. I wish you were on every news channel there is. Thank you I speak for my sisters and I that we hope that we hope that our parents and whole family are listening to this. Sorry, this is what happens when you're working from home now. Sorry. Thank you.
So now, is there
a website? I don't know if you're aware of it, Shannon. I wrote it down for you.
Oh, hang on. She muted her microphone there. So, okay.
Sorry, my daughter woke up from her nap and is in full force right now.
So just check out GetUSPPE.
Hang on, she's dealing
.org. With I'm sorry, it's .com. It's .org.
Hold it up a little higher, Fred. We can't see it. There you go.
Can you see it now?
Yep.
So it's not .com, it's .org. My mistake.
Okay, getuspppe.org.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. If you go to that site, you'll see they have a map of the United States. You click on where you're interested. They have two things. First, they say, are you interested in being a maker or being a donator? If you want to be a maker like you, you click the maker. They tell you what the process is to become a good maker. And there's some really important things in there, like, you know, wear gear so that you don't pollute what you're making, get the specs of the items pretty exactly so that we're not surprised in our, because you're making gowns. So, you know, folding the gowns, washing the gowns, they're doing hundreds of thousands of these a day. You can imagine those, you know, that if you have something special, it's hard for them sometimes to be able to do it effectively. They'll do it, but it's just, they could, you'll have to use, you know, you won't be able to be at scale in the washing system. So you make it under good conditions. You don't make it where you're preparing food. You don't make it with dirty hands. You make it with gloves and masks and eye protection, so that you're sure that you've got a pretty safe product when it goes out the door. And so they go through all that for you. And then if you click on the button, it'll say exactly what hospitals need what stuff. So you can go, you know, to California, you can hit, you know, Stanford. It'll say, you know, here is our drop-off point. Here's what we need in detail.
I appreciate that. We are hoping to, you know, I will look into this, get us PPE, except we are not just makers, we're professionals. So other thing is that we are looking into not only large-scale laundering after that's where, you know, we are in the currently large-scale laundering anything we make to sanitize it. But we're also starting to work with different laboratories to use their instrument cleaning and disinfecting machines as well. My mind can't recall what the name of those machines are, but you know, the ones that. So sanitation is the most important thing to us. I mean, thank you for reminding me about that.
And you know, so some of these guys, you know, don't realize that they, you know, donate materials and then it's difficult to be picked up by the system. But you know, it sounds like you're doing all the right things. Unfortunately, I couldn't hear your work because I had messed up the connection. I apologize.
What you just brought up is why we thought it was important to have the professionals making large scale PPEs. I just remembered the name of the machine is an autoclave. We're working with somebody to develop a process of autoclaving what we make. With gowns and stuff, you can just launder those at high heat for sanitation. But to take that stress off of the hospitals, we're looking into autoclave.
Yeah, the autoclaves are expensive and they're pretty complicated. I don't know if you're if you already have a facility to do that, that would be great. Because then they just roll in the gowns on a large system, and these are autoclaves that are the size of a room. They'll spray them with steam, and you know, they'll come out, and they'll be nicely sanitized. They do have to be clean though before you enter the autoclave, because the autoclave actually disinfects all the item completely. But if you have like a little speck of dirt and you break off the dirt within that area, it's still going to be contaminated. They have to make sure it's clean to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, this is a whole world of people coming together, you know, the medical professions. You know, I normally make gowns for people like Beyonce, and now I'm learning all about hospital gowns and how to, you know, I've never had to sanitize before. Of course, fortunately, the people within my organization do have some experience with that, and we're partnering with organizations that are specifically industrial designers and medical professionals. But this is a time where every American is trying to heed the call.
Okay. Yeah, no, it's important. People are running really short. And, you know, the biggest area is ventilators. That's really what's going to hurt people most. And then, you know, the next big area is masks. But after that, you're talking about gowns. That's probably, you know, number three or four. Gloves are really critical. Unfortunately, they're very complicated to make. They're mostly made in Malaysia. The reason they're critical is because Malaysia had a big viral outbreak and they had to shut down all their manufacturing. So we have no gloves. And so donation of gloves is getting to be really important.
And you were saying, Fred, that these booty things are like spats. Those are real important too, right?
Yeah, that's one of the most important areas is you know, closing off the shoe covers, the shoelets. You know, you can imagine you're stepping in things that all drops, everything kind of rolls off the gown onto the shoe coverlet. And then you take off if you don't have those on and you try to, you know, pull your laces, you get infected real fast.
We're working on making those as well. We were trying to reach the call for masks and gowns first, but that's something that can easily be made by apparel manufacturers.
That's great. Yeah, that, if, if you go onto the site, you'll see where most of the requests are, and gowns are almost always number 3-4. You know, wipes and disinfectants are different category. Those also are also very high. But that's great stuff that you're doing, Shannon. That's it's sort of all hands on deck. Every little bit helps. It's a huge volume they're going through. But I remember I heard one nurse being interviewed, and she said it's sort of like asking an EM, a firefighter, to run through a burning house in their underwear. You know, that's what we're sort of asking our healthcare workers to do, and it's not a bad analogy in terms of danger levels. So the gowns really make a huge difference.
All right, we're going to have to leave it at that. Why don't we let Shannon once again talk about the website that she's created for her folks. Go ahead and tell us that one more time.
Yes, I was just going to respond really quickly. Fortunately, unfortunately for us, everybody is unemployed. So we have the ability to focus all our resources on this, and we just want to be able to. And, you know, we're currently doing so, but we could be doing more. So if you want to contact us, we're at skilledlaborers.com. Skilledlaborers.com.
Okay, Fred, and if people want to reach out to you, how do they do that?
Well, actually, through you assigned, Matt, I also have a LinkedIn site. And if people have an urgent question, I'm fred.brown.ch@gmail.com. I'll get back to you.
All right. Thanks very much, Fred. Shannon, all our guests today. We're going to have to leave it there. We'll be back at 2:00 Eastern time next week, probably again in this format. Actually, certainly again in this format. Until then, this is Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you've been watching the M2 TechCast on mitechnews.tv.
Thank you.
Okay, are we out?
All right. Thanks, Shannon.
Thanks so
much. Yeah, you guys.
With the people, sorry.
Business, technology, and politics in Michigan. Join your hosts, Matt Rausch and Mike Brennan, next Monday at 3 p.m. If you can't listen live, audio podcasts of the show can be found at podcastdetroit.com.